Blog Talk Radio.
And a great big hello and welcome. You're listening to the Palm Springs Savant and Company radio show. I'm Rick Rockhill, your host, right here on Blog Talk Radio. Happy to be here today. This is show number 106. Today, we're going to be talking about one of America's favorite passions, chocolate. In fact, one of the world's favorite passions, and we're going to hear more about that today. Here today, this is I'm recording this show on Easter Sunday in the United States, and Easter is a major chocolate holiday for the Americans and people around the world, of course. It's a huge business. It's a huge part of the commercialization of the holiday, but it's just one point in time in a year-long obsession with chocolate. You might not be aware that chocolate is over an $18 billion business just in the United States alone. It's a huge, huge industry. And I'm covering this today with a unique perspective that I worked in the confectionery industry for a number of years. And so today's show, I'm going to give you some insights into that. We're going to talk about chocolate. We're going to talk about the industry, how it's made, and some of the favorites that we all have that show up in our Easter baskets each year on this holiday season. So let's just jump into it here, and let me start off by telling you some of my experience in this. In the 1990s, I worked for two different chocolate companies. I started off working with Fannie Farmer Candy Shops. They were originally founded in Boston, named after the cook, the chef, Fannie Farmer, Fannie Merritt Farmer, although she personally had nothing to do with the actual candy company. But the company was named in her after her, and she was very comfortable with that, or her family estate was, and it grew to be a very popular regional candy company. And at some point while I was working there, Fannie Farmer was acquired by a Chicago-based company with a similar name, Fannie Mae Candies. And they had no connection. They were started within a year of each other. It's just one of those things that they had happened to have a similar name. But they were based in the Midwest. Fannie Farmer was typically the East Coast. And they kind of lived in tandem. I had the privilege and honor of working for two great chocolate retail companies. I also, in that time, aside from running the retail portion of those stores, I had quite a bit of firsthand experience in the production side. And Fannie Mae Candies in Chicago, they had their old plant on 1137 West Jackson Boulevard. It was the West Loop, if you're familiar with the Chicago area. Anyhow, at the time, the president of the company who was running things, he believed strongly that people should, to work in a management capacity at Fannie Mae, you needed to learn the business, and that meant spending time in the kitchens, learning how the candy is made, and getting an appreciation for it. And that's exactly what I have to this day, an understanding, an appreciation, and a passion for chocolate that has really just carried me through these years, and now I'm in the pet industry, but I still look back on these years working with chocolate and just loving it to this day. So, that's my background, my credentials, if you will. I'm not an expert. I wouldn't profess to be, but I certainly know a heck of a lot more than many who've not had the opportunity to work firsthand, closely making chocolates. I personally made over 72 different types of chocolate myself with my own hands in the Fannie Mae candy plant at different points in my career there. So it was pretty cool. And these days, of course, for full disclosure, Fannie Mae is owned by a different set of owners today. They have a different production plant. It's not, you didn't enjoy it, but it's a different facility than what I'm referring to in this show. But it nonetheless will give you some insights on just how candies are made and so forth. Let's start off by talking about it. What is chocolate? What is it? Well, it comes from the cacao bean, and that's spelled C-A-C-A-O. And it's a tree. The Theobroma cacao is a species of tree that is seed. The cacao bean is found. It grows in pods, and they mature and ripen. They're large. They vary in size, but almost like the size of a papaya at times. and they grow, they kind of hang down, and then you, when they change to a certain ripe color, you knock them down, and they're dried, they're fermented, and the seed of that is what is used to make chocolate. So chocolate as we know it is really, it's a raw and then processed food from that seed of the tree. Now, it's been around a long time. We all talk about these fun obsessions with Americans and Europeans who love chocolate, but quite honestly, this has been around for at least three millennia. In Mexico, Central America, South America, Africa, the earliest time that we know of that chocolate or the cacao was used, and it was early days for drinking, was 1100 B.C. I mean, that's an enormous period of time when you think about how far back that goes. But Mesoamerican people were making chocolate drinks for health, to keep themselves healthy. The Aztecs, all kinds of cultures and civilizations recognized the health benefits of cacao. Now, the cacao itself has a very bitter taste. It's very strong and intense. And it has to be fermented to get that flavor that we know and love today. But that is the process that's used. Those little nibs of the seeds are ground up, and they create a very dark, strong, pure chocolate. And then typically that will be liquefied. And that's what's shipped to the candy companies, the confectionery companies that use it in mass quantities. So although you could purchase it yourself at a very expensive, the chocolate liquor is quite expensive because it's so intense. The major manufacturing companies buy it in huge volumes, of course, and then they blend it. They blend it into two components, either a cocoa solid or a cocoa butter, and that's how they will then, depending on what they're making, the confectionery companies use that chocolate liquor for that purpose. Some of the smaller companies will just buy the cocoa butter or cocoa solids already pre-made. They won't blend it themselves. But some of the finer candy companies out there have their own proprietary blend or their own recipe for making chocolate. And that's why chocolate tastes different. So you can go to a store and you could buy a Hershey bar or a Snickers bar or, a Ghirardelli or whatever you like, Cadbury, and they will taste somewhat different. It doesn't mean that one's better or worse. It's your personal preference, your favorites. But the difference is the proprietary blend that those companies use for their own style of making chocolate. And I should tell you that it's different in the United States from manufacturer to manufacturer, and our American style of chocolate is different than your various parts of Europeans. The Brits have a different flavor than the French and the Italians. I mean, the palate of the consumer is what drives it. And so people will often identify that or notice it when they go overseas and they'll have a candy bar somewhere and they'll think, that doesn't taste like what we have at home. Well, that's because the palates are different. So anyhow, most of the chocolate that's consumed today is what we call sweet chocolate. And that's when you combine, the companies combine cocoa solids, cocoa butter, some fats in there depending on their recipe, and certainly sugar. That's how sweet chocolate's made. Milk chocolate, of course, as you'd guess, is that sweet chocolate I described, but it also adds in milk. Sometimes they'll use condensed milk in a liquid form or a milk powder, but it's what gives it that lighter flavor, that lighter look than you see in the darker chocolate. And just let me put it out on the table right now. There really is no such thing as white chocolate because white chocolate has cocoa butter, sugar and milk, but no cocoa solids. So it really isn't true chocolate. It's more just a blend of flavorings and sugar and milk. But for people who have, God forbid, an allergy to chocolate or just don't like the flavor, that is an option for you, but don't be confused by that. Baking chocolate's a little different, but we're really not going to talk a lot about baking here today, so I'm going to skip over that. But dark chocolate, now that is the one that you hear so much about in the news. You make it by producing, you get the cocoa solids and so forth, and you do add the fat and the sugar to the cacao mixture. And this is at least a minimum of 15% concentration of that chocolate liquor, that really intense flavoring. Interestingly, the EU requires 35% cocoa solids. So it's much richer, darker, and that's why you'll notice that if you're overseas in the EU, you'll see that. But dark chocolate typically has a high cocoa content. And because of that, it has a number of health benefits. That has cardiovascular, cardioprotective properties. You know, less sugar the better, really, but the things that are in it make it better for you the more dark it is, I guess is how I would say it. But there are some physiological benefits. It's almost amazing when you look back because something was happening, you know, in 1100 BC that they recognized the benefit, the health benefits of eating it, and they weren't really all that wrong. But dark chocolate has been linked to healthy levels of serotonin in the brain. And it believes if you eat it in moderation, the dark chocolate, it can help lower blood pressure. But most typically people talk about it that it does help with prevention or limiting the frequency of heart attack if you have it regularly in small amounts with low sugar content. So those are the kind of things that are interesting in the health perspective. There are some studies that suggest that really dark chocolate is a nootropic, and it delays the age, you know, the decline of the brain and memory and things like that, some of the brain functions. So, I'm all about eating chocolate. So if it can help me keep my mind in order till I'm old, sounds good to me. But no question, chocolate has become one of the most popular foods and flavors in the world today. It is remarkable when you think about how long this has been going on. So let me take you through a timeline here. Oh, by the way, if you want to send me any information today while it's on the show or even afterward, you can do so one of three ways. Twitter, you can find me at Rick Rockhill, just one word. Email rickrockhill@msn.com or on my blog, rickrockhill.blogspot.com. Do not hesitate to drop me a line. I do have some notes in the mailbag that I'll cover shortly, but let's jump over to this timeline here first. So, chocolate. What is it about chocolate that has so fascinated people? So I'm going to jump to about in the range of 250 to 900 AD. The Mayans, the ancient Mayans people, they discovered the benefits of cacao. These are very smart people in Central America who were very educated for their time. And they recognized the value of this from their rainforests. They planted, they had these huge plantations, and they harvested them, and they made it into a paste. And it was a bitter beverage that they made. And it was very rudimentary, but that was as early as 250 AD. Then, interestingly, in 950 AD, cacao beans were so valued and prized, they were used as currency. The Mayans believed that it would be a good health property and high value, so it was a form of payment, and the very wealthy people stockpiled it. They had an excess of cacao beans, and that they would either trade it or they'd be able to make a drink, but the very wealthy believed that at a very early time in our history, believed that drinking the chocolate paste drink gave them wisdom and power, and so that was a very early belief. Then in 1200 or so, the Aztecs, look, records right on the history books here. Not only was it traded as currency, but it started getting into the major trade routes between the Aztecs through Mexico and the Mayans. When the Aztecs conquered the Mayans, they were doing it to get these plantations, these crops. There were these Aztec priests who really were offering up the cacao seeds to the gods. It was a sacrifice in honor of the war they had with the Mayans. So, I mean, it played a prominent role in history then. But then it wasn't until 1502, 300 years later, that Christopher Columbus, he came over and discovered the cocoa bean. It was, I think, his fourth voyage here to North America, actually in the Americas. He ended up in Nicaragua is where it was. And he discovered cocoa beans. But he himself really wasn't interested in them. He was trying to get further along the way. It was just a pit stop, so to speak. But through those 1500s, you know, cocoa beans, cacao started getting a little more play. It moved over into Europe. The Spaniards began trading it, and it really became much more of an interesting trade item, along with spices and chili peppers and all sorts of things, cornmeal. So the Europeans were getting in on this. And close to the 1700s, in England, was the first time that a chocolate store opened up. So this is an interesting point. 1657, a store in London. It was a store that really was seasonal, but it was very expensive. It was the first time chocolate was used in making some baked good items. It was made in some chocolate to eat, a solid form, and even a drink. But it was so expensive, it was only for the super rich. And so all the way through the 1700s, right on through the 1800s, coffee houses started opening up where they were serving little tiny bits and slices of chocolate. The Italians, the French, the Germans, and the Swiss all began working with this in their coffee houses. But finally, it made its way to Boston in the early years of the United States as a colony, and it was a part of the trade route, the trade market. And it wasn't until 1760, right around there, in Massachusetts, the first chocolate mill was put together, and an Irishman by the name of John Hannan, he was the first chocolate mill owner in the United States, in North America, actually. And then shortly after that, James Baker, you may recall him from his name from the baking chocolate, they started the Baker Chocolate Company in Dorchester, Massachusetts. And that company gained a worldwide reputation as a mill, and was acquired by General Foods in the 1927 timeframe. So he built one of the earliest major plants. But chocolate, it then moved right on through to mass production. Hershey's in 1895 made chocolate. Milton Hershey made chocolate a huge mass production effort, and then launched a universal appetite for this confection in the United States. So where does all this come in? Well, I worked for Fannie Mae Candy, and they opened in 1920. And wow, pretty cool. During the war, sugar was rationed. Ingredients were scarce. They made the same recipes that were difficult to get the hands-on ingredients, but they had lines of people who were trying to get just a bite of chocolate from the Fannie Mae stores. So it was that history that kind of brought chocolate to America mainstream, and people just would pay the price because it was so good. So we talked about the health benefits. What about the flavors? Why is it that people like it so well? What is it about chocolate that makes people so excited and so willing to pay the price regardless of what the cost is? Well, no surprise, the candy companies made a big deal out of it, and they started launching it into holiday seasonal items very early on. They made molded chocolates around the holidays to encourage people to try it. At very early ages, in the early stages rather, 1920s and 30s, it was not uncommon to see molded Easter rabbits, chocolate Santas, Christmas trees, chocolate hearts. So they were catching people's attention through the seasonal holidays, and that's continued right on till today. So if you look back and far enough in history, you'll see that those things were the driving force. It was the seasonality of this that has now grown chocolate into an $18 billion business, and that's growing rapidly and will continue to grow. So this is not a small business. Now, my time in the candy business was pretty cool. As I mentioned, I personally made just about every type of candy that Fannie Mae made, everything from the famous Trinidads, the milk and dark chocolate-covered buttercreams, Pixies, those are the turtles that people know and love, some of the most popular candies I had the opportunity to make hands-on. And so I personally loved it. It was a passion for me. In fact, I remember in the offices at Fannie Mae, you could eat as much chocolate as you wanted. And they had just pans of it laying all over the office. Anywhere you wanted, you could just roll your chair over and reach out and grab a handful, and you could sit and eat candy all day long. And believe me, I did. But it was a joy to go into the kitchens and work. And let me tell you a little bit about some of the ways that chocolate was made. So we had, at Fannie Mae, the experience was small batches. nothing, although it was definitely a plant, a factory, they had made it for large quantities, they still made it in smaller batches, which the handmade aspect of Fannie Mae was what made it taste so unique and different, and part of the appeal, quite honestly. So what was going on there was they literally would have these mixers, these huge mixers. Think of like a KitchenAid mixer, okay, except it would be, you know, large enough for a fairly substantial vat. But anyway, they would be putting in these sticks of butter and cream, actual whole cream, heavy cream would be put in. And so the blending of the chocolate, everything was done in individual batches, much like you would make a cake. And when you had something, let's say, let's just take a typical, you know, piece of candy in a box. So you might, let's just say a buttercream. So you'd have separate processes going where the actual center that was being made, the filling, was made in one area. And those were put through these machines that would automatically put out to the correct size. They'd kind of drop in, so it would push through the buttercream center through a machine that would pass on a conveyor belt. And these long conveyor belts, they ran, oh, I don't know, maybe I want to say a couple hundred feet long, and they would be moving very, very slowly. So the cooked buttercream center, all that would have the precise, exact consistency. People would be testing it, making sure the flavor was right. They'd do test batches, and it would go through this machine, and it would flow along, and the machinery would drop out the exact proportion size for the center, and it would move along on a belt. It was like a screen belt. And at some point, it would pass through what they call an enrober. And the enrober was just a point on this production line, on the conveyor belt, that the chocolate would drape down over that row of the center, the buttercream centers. And there would be literally thousands of little drops of the buttercream centers moving along slowly on this conveyor belt, and it would pass underneath the chocolate enrober along the flow. So the chocolate would come down. And at that precise moment, the pieces of candy would be enrobed, covered in the chocolate, and then it would continue gliding. And then just at some point after the top was covered, from beneath, because remember, the conveyor was a screen, so from beneath, another row of chocolate would be at the bottom and would come through the screen and would coat the base. So the process was that they'd be, the center was made, it would be covered and robed in chocolate, and then it would continue passing. At that moment, the base would come up and cover the bottom. And now they would be sitting on this little screen, and the conveyor would flow, and they'd continue to pass. And the flow of the conveyor would be long enough for the exterior to cool somewhat. So the warm chocolate that had enrobed it, was now allowed to cool long enough so that the candies could be passed on the line. And then further down the line, you may be surprised to hear this, at Fannie Mae, handmade packing. They would have, at that time, they were ladies who were there, and they were wearing all white hairnets, and they'd be moving and would individually place these candies into little white paper cups, and they would pack them into pans of chocolate. So they had these, maybe they were 18 inches long and 12 inches wide, something like that, rectangle pans, and they'd be placed in these metal pans, and they would be packed, and they'd be set aside, and they would cool in these bakery-type rolling bins, and then, of course, they would be sent to another room when they were ready to be packed into pre-assorted boxes. So you would go and buy from Fannie Mae a colonial assortment, and they would have a certain number of buttercreams in them. So they would pull those pans later and then pack those all by hand to make those pre-assorted boxes. So that was, kind of layman's terms here, but that was the process that was used to make Fannie Mae candies. Now, what was really neat was things like turtles. Those had the pecans, same idea. Basically, the cream center wasn't there, right? It's just pecans. We dropped it on the conveyor, and then little drizzles of caramel would go on top of them, and then they would go through the enrober just like I described. So pixies, that you know them, were made that same fashion. That's the process of enrobing chocolate. I've got a couple questions that came in. I had posted this topic previously, so I had a few emails that came in. Let me just answer these questions. Kathy in Boca, Florida, sent me a note and said, how do they really make chocolate-covered cherries? Well, Kathy, a great question, and that is an interesting one. It is different by company. Some companies make a molded chocolate where, say, like a Godiva, for example, although I've not seen their plant, it's molded, so what you would look at is the top is actually in a mold upside down, and there's a chocolate filling of the mold, and then it continues on, and then a machine drops in the liquid center, and a cherry, and then another enrober goes along the top and coats them, and it kind of seals it. That's a molded chocolate-covered cherry. When I was at Fannie Mae, however, those were all done by hand, just like that old Lucille Ball episode when she and Ethel were in the plant. But these were done individually dipping them, and they had pots of the white fondant mixture, and these ladies had these little tiny forks. They almost looked like cocktail forks, and they would dip them in very quickly. They were paid by the piece, by the way, so they were moving quickly, and they hated it when I would be on the line because I'd slow them down. But these wonderful ladies in Chicago were busy making these, dipping them in the fondant and moving them, and they'd go on the enrober and they'd be coated just like the other centers would, all handmade. So those were really pretty cool. Elizabeth in Kona, Hawaii, actually sent an email. I don't know who Elizabeth is, but her question is, how do they make chocolate-flavored coffee? Is it with real chocolate? Well, it is, and it depends, again, on the manufacturer. Those are usually made with the cocoa powder, and it's baked in or cooked in with the coffee beans. That's typically how it's done. Some companies will also do it with a chocolate liquor, and they will coat it, and then the oils will be blended in. And then sometimes it's strictly regular coffee, but they just put chocolate syrup in. It just depends on who it is. But if it's coffee-flavored beans, it's usually cooked with the cocoa powder. Okay, last question came in. One last email was Peter in Casper, Wyoming. He's someone who reads my blog. He asked, why are some chocolate rabbits hollow and some solid? Well, Peter, it really comes down to finances. The hollow ones are cheaper to make than the solid ones, less chocolate, and the retail price comes down, and that's why the companies made their some of them hollow and some of them solid. So that's the only reason why they're different, cost. Okay, another thing I just want to cover here is the traditions of Easter. Things that have come around over the years, like an Easter basket, those things are part of the culture of America because there's a variety of candy in there, and the Easter Bunny comes and brings them, and it's really, it is very commercial. But I can tell you that as a kid, I remember getting an Easter basket. I can remember going to, at that time, growing up in New England, my grandmother, great-grandmother, we'd go to the Fannie Farmer candy shop, and I would be able to pick out a chocolate lollipop or something like that. I just always had a strong memory. But I'll never forget the Easter baskets we would get. And what was great about them was the variety of things in the basket. And so the things that were great were the cream-filled eggs with the yolk center. Those were made the same process I explained, very simple but all handmade. The foil-wrapped chocolate eggs are made in an automated fashion, but they're covered automatically in the different colored foil. Those are all the same quality chocolate that Fannie Mae used for every single piece that they had produced. And I can just tell you that chocolate was a big part of my life growing up. It still is today. And you should continue to eat chocolate for your health, but in moderation. Dark chocolate will keep you healthy. I want to thank you all for listening. We've run out of time today. Please send me a note. Visit my blog, rickrockhill.blogspot.com. Send me a tweet at @rickrockhill on Twitter, or email rickrockhill@msn.com. Thank you so much for listening, and hope you have a wonderful spring season. I'll be back again next week here at the Palm Springs Savant and Company, right here on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Rick Rockhill, your host. Thanks so much for listening.